This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka. Security forces in Myanmar fired on protesters on Sunday, killing at least 18 people and leaving more than 30 others injured. According to the UN Human Rights Office, it is the deadliest day of demonstrations since the February 1st military coup. The office spokesperson, Ravina Shamdasani, said in a statement, quote, "Throughout the day, in several locations throughout the country, police and military forces have confronted peaceful demonstrations using lethal force and less than lethal force." The statement also called on the military to immediately halt the use of force against peaceful protesters. The new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, tweeted, "We stand in solidarity with the people of Burma who have displayed determination and courage in rejecting the military coup." Fighters thought to belong to the notorious Allied Democratic Forces militia killed 10 civilians in two overnight attacks in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. That's according to the Army on Sunday. Army spokesman Lieutenant Jules Ngongo said ADF fighters decapitated 8 villagers in the village of Boyo in the northeast Ituri province and shot dead 2 civilians in Kainama. He added soldiers were in pursuit of the attackers. Local officials confirmed the 2 attacks, adding that houses were also burned in the violence. Hong Kong police say 47 Hong Kong Democrats and activists have been charged with 1 count each of conspiracy to commit subversion, the charge falling under the new national security law. You can read the full story on voanews.com. This is VOA News. An internal U.S. government report obtained by the New York Times says Ethiopia is conducting a systematic campaign of ethnic cleansing. The campaign is under the cover of war in the Tigray region. The region is an area largely controlled by Amhara militias in the northern part of the country. According to the Times, the report finds that Ethiopian officials and allied fighters from the neighboring Amhara region are deliberately and efficiently rendering Western Tigray ethnically homogenous through the organized use of force and intimidation. The officials and militia moved into Tigray in support of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a statement Saturday that the United States is gravely concerned by reports of atrocities and overall deteriorating situation in the Tigray. Saudi columnists said on Sunday Saudi Arabia's sovereignty is a red line. The nation is ramping up rhetoric in defense of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman after a U.S. intelligence report implicated him in the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Prince Mohammed, who is the de facto ruler of the U.S.-allied Gulf powerhouse, has denied any involvement in the 2018 murder of Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The foreign ministries of the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Kuwait are now expressing support for Saudi Arabia. Kuwait's foreign ministry said Saudi Arabia plays an important role regionally and internationally in its rejection of violence and extremism. Khashoggi, a columnist for the Washington Post, was murdered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018, and a number of top Saudi officials were arrested in connection with the case. Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels on Sunday claimed the attempted strikes had targeted neighboring Saudi Arabia overnight and threatened more attacks as fighting in the civil war escalates. Houthi rebels have intensified operations against the kingdom as airstrikes by the Saudi-led military coalition pound rebel positions in the north of Yemen in a bid to stop their offensive to seize the government's last northern stronghold of Marib. Infectious disease experts are expressing concern about Pope Francis's upcoming trip to Iraq. They are citing a sharp rise in coronavirus infections there, a fragile healthcare system, and the unavoidable likelihood that Iraqis will crowd to see him. No one wants to tell the Pope not to make the March trip, and the Iraqi government has every interest in welcoming him to the country for the first time. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
I'm very confident that I will prevail. President Talon in 5 years of power is the most unpopular first-term president ever in the history of our country.
Benin goes to the polls to choose a new president on April 11.
Nearly what, $9,000, $8,000 in damages to what was done to me. I don't have a uterus. I don't have a womb, for crying out loud. I might have found another child if I had still had my womb. What would make me feel safe coming back to Uganda? The authorities have to just let us be.
A Ugandan human rights activist expresses concern about threats on her life.
New arrivals are reporting grave human rights abuses inside CAR. Our colleagues in Gore, in Chad, are caring for a 26-year-old refugee mother who was beaten and raped by a rebel with her six-month-old baby by her side after fleeing her home.
And the UN Refugee Agency is appealing for funds for assistance and protection for victims of conflict in the Central African Republic. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Benin goes to the polls to choose a new president on April 11. Incumbent President Patrick Talon seeks a second five-year term, but opposition groups say it is difficult to meet the requirements needed to challenge Mr. Talon in the presidential vote. This despite assurances from the Electoral Commission that the vote will be transparent. To compete in the polls, a candidate must be sponsored by at least 16 mayors or members of parliament. Rekia Madugu, who leads the opposition party, the Democrats, was disqualified from contesting in the upcoming presidential vote. Ms. Madugu, who was a former special advisor to the Togolese president before deciding to declare her candidacy, is an entrepreneur and a lobbyist who has won several international accolades, including the U.S. government's Women of Courage Award. She tells me that Beninese were enthusiastic about her candidacy, which she argued appears to have been seen as a threat to the president's re-election bid.
Well, it's with enthusiasm that my candidacy is being received by the people of Benin, not only because I am a female candidate, although this is an added value, but also because I represent a real alternative to President Talon, as the country is fed up with President Talon's authoritarianism, bad governance, and stalled development.
What do you think your chances are, realistically, to win the upcoming election?
Indeed, as far as we are concerned, and based on the Commission's track record under this administration, we have serious reservations about the opacity and integrity of the process. For example, all the members of the Electoral Commission are mostly from the presidential camp. So this is concerning and doesn't guarantee fairness.
Previous opposition candidates have accused the Electoral Commission of bias and doing the bidding of the government, or for that matter, the president. Do you trust the Electoral Commission to organize free, fair, transparent, and credible presidential election?
If the electoral process is free, fair, equitable, and inclusive, and if President Talon allows the people of Benin to express their will at the ballot box, contrary to what he's attempting to do, I'm very confident that I will prevail. President Talon, in 5 years of power, is the most unpopular first-term president ever in the history of our country.
Some Beninese are saying that perhaps the powers that be do not see you as a strong threat to the incumbent, and that is why you were not prevented
from contesting. But what is your response to such critics?
This is a joke. If it was the case, then why are they now going so vigorously after me and are arresting my close associated prominent members of my party? As you might have heard, few days ago, the government has summoned the vice president of LD and two of us members to the Quiet Criminal Court of Exception on bogus allegations of plotting insurrections. And also yesterday, it was the same case for a prominent member of the party from the north in Paracu.
Rekia Madugu leads the Beninese opposition party, the Democrats. She spoke with me from the capital, Cotonou. In Uganda, human rights activist Nana Annette Namata says she left the country following threats on her life. Also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, Ms. Namata says threats to harm her and her family increased during the recent electoral process. But supporters of the government expressed doubt about her claims, saying the authorities could have prevented her from leaving the country. They say her accusations are unpatriotic and have tarnished the country's reputation abroad. Civil society and opposition groups accused the military and the police of human rights abuses during the recent polls. The abuses, they also say, continue with the ongoing arrest of critics and opponents of the administration. To learn more about her decision to leave Uganda, I reached Nana Annette Namata, also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa.
Just like any human being, everybody wants to leave. Looking at the fact that a number of the activists I worked with, two had been abducted, two had been confirmed, just arrested, the normal arrest, and thrown into military courts. And I know that one of them has actually been in prison for more than 2 months, close to 2 months now. Another was actually got much way before the election. So that one is going to 4 months in jail. So much as we really want to stand and boldly motivate the others to speak up and to call for better for everybody, to call for peace and to call for better governance and a chance at everyone developing and enjoying living in their country, it just gets to a time when one must think about their very lives. There were too many threats.
Some people are suggesting that you left the country voluntarily and that you were not prevented from fleeing the country. That shows that there's tolerance and that some of these allegations you are making are unfounded and that the authorities could have simply prevented you from leaving the shores or just going out of the country. How do you respond to that?
It's very true. For me, I have not mentioned it anywhere that I have, for example, gone into exile or call myself a refugee. Personally, I have not gone away to go away. But the moment was too heated. The news was too hard to bear every other time. This one is missing, that one is missing. I mean, given the things we have engaged in before, the calls we have made before on the very people that we think are abducting these people, the very people that are arresting Ugandans for their mere belief, I found it a very urgent matter that I had to leave. It's tiring to feel scared all the time.
Are you teaming up or working closely with Dr. Stella Nyanzi, who also left Uganda claiming that she fears for her life, you know, due to political repression and other allegations she made?
Teaming up, maybe not. No. Apart from the messaging of how is your son? My son had been sick when we first came. My son fell sick. Apart from the friendship message, a good morning, how are the kids? Are you fine? How are you doing? Teaming up for work, it hasn't been so. I'm not happy with the way she's been seeming to like critique people that I feel are taking a much bigger risk being there, being at home. And
you know, with us being away, either for, you know, reasons of feeling safer. I lashed at her for some messages she's been posting, particularly about Bobby Wine.
Now, you expressed concern that you don't feel safe. That is why you left Uganda. So what will make it safer for you to return?
I didn't feel safe in Uganda for quite some time. I haven't felt safe there for quite some time. I mean, given the things that have been done to me. So you're asking what would make me feel safe to return in Uganda? I don't even know how to answer that. I mean, charges that have been put on us unfairly, they have to be dropped. I have to have the freedom to do my daily work freely and to say what I want to say when I want to say it, as long as it's not hurting anyone or breaking the law. So for me, those things like, you know, the court case that we put there, I wanted it to be privately go for these police people, and then the state took the case and owned it. How does state, the ones that are responsible for what was done to me, be the ones to assume they can take my case and give me justice? How do I believe that? When the ruling in the civil court came out, there was $9,000, $8,000 in damages to what was done to me. I don't have a uterus. I don't have a womb, for crying out loud. I might have found another child if I had still had my womb. What would make me feel safe coming back to Uganda? The authorities have to just let us be.
Nana Annette Namata, who is also known as Mwafrika Mbarikiwa, is a Ugandan human rights activist. She spoke with me from an undisclosed location. In Morocco, the Trophy of Africanity Foundation plans to hold a three-day summit on women beginning April 5. The meeting, officials say, will give African women the opportunity to talk about their success stories and the project they are undertaking. This, they say, will help empower women and young girls on the continent. Organizers say the summit will compile a list of recommendations how international unity can help address challenges facing African women. Officials say the Trophy Africanity Foundation honors both men and women who contribute to the development of Africa's cultural, economic, and sports activities. To learn more about the upcoming summit, I reached Nasrallah Belkhayati, president of the foundation.
Trophy Africanity is born 7 years ago, and we give for 130 person the Trophy Africanity for one action, for action for Africa. So now we, for the first time, we work under United Nations. December 2020, we organize the first Africa Summit. We invite 70 African women to speak to the world which project and how they work for this project.
What is the objective of this April's summit? What is the objective this year?
This year, the objective is for the world to know how they fight for to success their project.
Does the organization also work with other international partners to support the work these women or selected women do to help them to be successful in what they want to do?
No, now we are looking for this. Okay, the aim of this second summit is to introduce training and mentoring programs to enhance female leadership in several areas. We are looking for international partners for that. It's very important. We need to say how we can help this woman. That's our message. We are messenger of this cry, the cry of woman in Africa. With this summit, second summit, we want to tell, yes, you have to know how you can help this woman. When you list this woman, you understand how you can help them. That's the objective of our summit. Because when we help women, we help the family and we help the country.
Nasrallah Belkayate is the president of the Trophy of Africanity Foundation. He spoke with me from the Moroccan capital, Rabat. When Joseph Biden was sworn in as the new U.S. president, he represented a sharp departure from his predecessor, Donald Trump. This has already proved to be especially true in foreign policy, where Biden promises to take a more conciliatory tone with America's allies and a sterner stance with adversaries. To get one African expert's recommendations on foreign policy toward Africa should be, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Idiyat Hassan, director of the Center for Democracy and Development, a Nigerian-based think tank dedicated focused on West Africa. Hassan began by rejecting a top-down approach, favoring instead a more bottom-up grassroots strategy.
The traditional approach for previous administration has been to promote democracy through the state apparatus, but it has not been useful. So to counter this, we are encouraging the Biden administration to engage more collaboration between American and African news organizations, civil rights law firms, civil society organizations, youth groups, because Africans are open to multi-party democracy. They want constitutionalism, they want liberal values, and above all, they want rights, right. That's what Africans actually want.
What else do you recommend?
The U.S. should continue to impose sanctions on anti-democratic forces, but specific people, not one that actually targets the country. Uganda is an example of what happened during the last elections. We know that there were very senior military commanders who falsely imprisoned the opposition politician Bobi Wine for days and his wife, and he was not even able to exercise his freedom of movement. Those persons should be identified and sanctioned. The same for Nigeria during the NSAS protest. We know people who actually killed protesters, and they should be identified and sanctioned. But when sanctions are unilaterally applied on a country, it is the people who actually suffer, while the perpetrators travel to different parts of the world to enjoy their look.
Earlier this month, President Biden issued an historic memorandum putting the U.S. at, quote, the forefront of the struggle, close quote, for LGBTQ rights. Your reaction?
LGBT rights are human rights. But on the flip side, addressing LGBT rights as a cornerstone of the Biden administration policy has got the effect of pushing Africa into the hands of China, because a blanket promotion of LGBT rights is construed as being against the culture of the people, as well as the religion of the people, aside from the laws which some autocrats have promulgated.
What about America's economic competition with China in terms of investments on the continent?
America does not necessarily have to compete with China in terms of investments. What it needs to do is emphasize people-to-people engagement, people-to-people learning, company-to-company, organizations to organizations, because soft power is able to tilt in the favor of the United States.
In terms of security, President Trump favored a very vigorous military approach, as opposed to a more humanitarian one favoring aid, for example. What should President Biden do?
The United States will have to refrain from a over-militarized approach on the continent. So if you look at Boko Haram, at the north of Mali, even ongoing in Mozambique, the heavy-handed approach allows for people to nurse grievances. More resources should be on winning the hearts and the mind of the people, while also addressing the root causes of some of this insecurity.
What was the reaction to President Biden's decision to nominate Linda Thomas-Greenfield to be U.S. ambassador to the U.N.? She was, of course, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under President Obama.
Many people on the continent was very excited. It means that there will be much more collaboration with African countries. People are not expecting that Biden will actually be doing many activities in their country. But looking at the UN and the kind of investment America will actually be putting back into the UN, it's expected to have impacts in our home countries.
Diyad Hassan is director of the Center for Democracy and Development, a Nigeria-based think tank. He spoke with viewers Adam Phillips in New York. UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, is appealing for $164 million for assistance and protection for nearly 1.5 million Central Africans uprooted by conflict and violence. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Civil conflict in the Central African Republic has uprooted about one-third of the country's population of 4.7 million, most now refugees in neighboring countries. A new wave of violence triggered by December's disputed presidential election in the CAR has added to the nearly 1.3 million refugees in the region. The UN Refugee Agency says 100,000 more people are newly displaced inside CAR. It says another 111,000 people have joined the exodus to neighboring countries. UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshakov says most of the refugees have gone to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The rest have sought refuge in Cameroon, Chad, and the Republic of the Congo.
New arrivals are reporting grave human rights abuses inside CAR. Our colleagues in Gor, in Chad, are caring for a 26-year-old refugee mother who was beaten and raped by a rebel with her six-month-old baby by her side after fleeing her home. She is now pregnant as a result of the assault and is receiving medical and psychosocial support from our teams.
The CAR is one of the poorest countries and one of the most underfunded emergencies in the world. The UNHCR says it urgently needs financial contributions to deliver protection and assistance to the rising number of vulnerable people inside the CAR and in host countries. Despite limited resources, Cheshakov says the UNHCR has scaled up border and protection monitoring. He says it also is supporting survivors of sexual violence and helping to mitigate the risk of further gender-based violence.
We're also working to reduce the risk of COVID-19 infections by building and equipping quarantine centers and areas for treatment and isolation, as well as testing, distributing masks, raising awareness on COVID-19 prevention and social distancing by improving water, sanitation, and health resources.
The UNHCR says the situation is particularly challenging in the DRC. It reports many of the 92,000 newly arrived refugees are spread among 40 remote places close to the volatile border. It notes the new arrivals now outnumber the local population. It adds the refugees are living in makeshift shelters without access to vital services such as education and health care. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hello, this is James Barton, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. But first, South Africa has held its annual International Public Arts Festival despite the coronavirus pandemic and social distancing measures. Turnout was low, but those attending welcomed the street festival as a chance to get out of the house, as Vinicius Assis reports from Cape Town.
Scores of people attended the opening of the International Public Arts Festival in Cape Town this month. Even though South Africa has been the African country worst hit by the coronavirus pandemic, the annual street arts festival strictly followed the government's COVID-19 rules, including no groups larger than 50 people, said one of the organizers, Alexandre Tumas.
The best way was to split people, because we are painting outdoors and the artists are outdoors. Every guest that wants to visit us, we put them in tiny little groups and we send them visit the neighborhood.
The artists changed the landscape in the South River neighborhood, a former industrial area made famous by the colorful murals. The 5-year-old festival usually attracts artists from abroad. But this year, because the pandemic's travel restrictions, just two showed up to create their murals. Despite the low turnout, festivals like IPAF should be held to boost South Africa's struggling tourism sector, says tour guide Annalisa Zigana.
You know, you need to sanitize, we need to keep our social distance. If we keep to those regulations, then I think it's still okay. So we can continue with the festivals, but just make sure that we keep to the regulations, yeah.
The World Travel Awards has voted Cape Town Africa's leading festival and event destination for the last 3 years. But the tourism sector also is suffering amid the pandemic, and Cape Town canceled all big events again this year. Nonetheless, festival attendees like Leti Mabuan welcomed the break from pandemic lockdown measures aimed at preventing the virus from spreading.
The fact that it's still happening, even the pandemic is still going on, and I feel like we are in need of this. We are in need of being out, of interacting with people, even if we have the mask.
South Africa, a year ago, applied one of the severest lockdowns worldwide, with restrictions on gatherings, movement, and sales of alcohol. The country has registered the highest number of confirmed cases on the continent, with nearly 1.5 million infections and more than 48,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University. COVID-19 is the illness caused by the coronavirus. This year's festival displayed more than 100 murals and focused on 3 points: creativity, sustainability, and safety. Vinicius Assis for VOA News, Cape Town.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's start with the African Champions League. On Wednesday, DR Congo's TP Mazembe finished with 10 men as they drew 0-0 in Sudan with Al Hilal. While on Tuesday, 9-time winners Al Ahly lost 1-0 in Tanzania to Simba in front of an estimated 30,000 fans. 5-time champions Zamalek of Egypt was also held to a goalless draw by Senegalese Tangwith. In the other game in this group, DR Congo's AS Vita club recovered from conceding an early goal in Sudan to Al Merrikh to win 4-1. Those results mean Simba top the group with a maximum 6 points. Vita club and Ahly have 3 points each, and Merrikh remained pointless. Simba travel to Merrikh next, then host the Sudanese side and Vita Club before going to Cairo to meet Ahly on April 9th or April 10th. Wydad Casablanca of Morocco, who have been champions, runners-up and semi-finalists twice in the past five seasons, began their Group C campaign with a 1-0 win at Petro Luanda of Angola. In the other Group C games, South African club Kaizer Chiefs were held goalless by Horaya of Guinea in Soweto. Four-time champions Esperance of Tunisia stayed top of the group thanks to a 1-1 away draw with Mamelodi Alger. Both Zamalek and Alger have 2 points after two draws, while Tanguet has 1 point. Meanwhile, Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel beat visiting Young Buffaloes of Eswatini 2-0 in the postponed second leg of their Confederation Cup playoff tie on Tuesday. Now Etoile join their Tunisian rivals CX Sfaxien in Group C of the second-tier Continental Club Tournament. CS Sfaxien are the most successful team in Confederation Cup history, having lifted the trophy 3 times since the tournament was launched in 2004. The group stage matches are due to begin next month, with the top two in each group progressing to the quarterfinals. Still in football, the Libyan Football Federation announced the first steps in the lifting of a ban on the use of its stadiums for international matches. Due to security issues, Libyan clubs and its national team have not been able to play at home for more than 7 years. Once the ban has been formally lifted, Al Ahly Benghazi could host their first home game in the group phase of the African Confederation Cup against Entente Satif of Algeria on March 17th. Also, the Libyan national team can host neighbors Tunisia in an African Cup of Nations qualifier a week later. And Olympic 800 meters champion Caster Semenya will reportedly appeal to the European Court of Human Rights against the restriction of testosterone levels in female runners. Semenya is not allowed to compete in events between 400 meters and a mile without taking testosterone-reducing drugs, following a 2019 rule change by governing body World Athletics. The 30-year-old South African lost an appeal to Switzerland's Federal Supreme Court in September, but still harbors hopes of defending her Olympic title in Tokyo later this year. And that's it for this edition of Netherland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Netherland Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Man, I come there already, no. I'll be right beside you. Like the wall of Jericho. They don't know, they don't know. They don't know what's going on. Monagiso, 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 my baby boy. I'll be a soldier for you. I'm getting better in Kung Fu. You should know I got you. And you don't need to guide me too. I'll be right beside you. In anything that you do. If you ever need saving, I will be running to you. Running, running, running to you. I'll be running to you. Running, running, running to you. Anywhere that you go to, running, running, running to you. I've been running to you, running, running, running to you. Anywhere that you go to.
When I'm looking for trouble, it's 'cause I know that I got you. Wanting my best, everybody, oh, oh. And it's because of your Kung Fu. And any time that I'm out of control, you hold me down. You never, never let go. Yeah. Unagiso, oh, unagiso, unagiso, my baby boo. See all the battles you'll be fighting, and I'll be right there with you. I may be small, but I'm mighty, and I go running for you. And anybody waves, I'll be, yes, don't be.
basajja tubalabukidde n'abakazi bitala bibazikiridde kalikubonya changa mukwano tumire n'omwami wange oli kwenjagala bitegere
Baby, I go fight for. Omo again, na you, say na you, I go die for. I don't get moto, but na you, I go ride for. When I dey sing, say na you, I dey sing for. Why baby dance, make you move for the dance floor. Omo again, she know me, me, you dey fun for. Why slow, boogie down low. Na the first time where I dey in love, oh. It be like drug where they make me slow. Anywhere you go, I go follow you go. Mogbe, oh. Yeah.
j'aimerais que tu reviennes, tu sais je ne suis qu'un homme, des erreurs j'en referai, te souviens-tu du temps où tu ne savais pas qui j'étais, un homme imprévisible, c'est tout ce dont tu rêvais, dis-moi que tu m'aimes, que tu m'aimes, c'est la vie, j'ai trahi, et ça m'a fait grandir, j'en perds ma taille, et dans la nuit, je vois que tu souris, écoute-moi je t'en C'est comme ça que je t'aime, mais tes souvenirs me hantent. La nuit dans mon sommeil, j'en deviens somnambule. Et je t'avais pris pour acquis, tu m'as tourné le dos. J'avais cru soumise, tous ces mots sonnent faux. Et quoi qu'on en dise, j'étais ton héros. Aujourd'hui tu me fuis, tu me fuis. C'est la vie, j'ai trahi, et ça m'a fait grandir. J'en perds ma taille.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Bill Eagle and reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, gold, like the sun, melts wax and hardens clay. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.